from KQED.
Welcome to Forum on the Road. I'm Michael Krasny, and we are broadcasting live from the 81st Avenue branch of the Oakland Public Library. In this digital age, with vast amounts of information available at our fingertips at any time, how does a public library stay relevant? Libraries have always been just as much about the communities they serve as the books they hold, and the 81st Avenue branch serves as the library for two public elementary schools, as a place to get bike repairs, and it's a gathering place providing information, community, and services in an East Oakland neighborhood that is too often underserved. Coming up, we'll talk about the future of libraries. Forum on the Road, coming up. Welcome to Forum on the Road. We are at the 81st Avenue branch of the Oakland Public Library. And obviously have a live studio audience here, and depending on when you drop in, this library branch serves as a support group for fathers, a drop-in center for legal advice, and a bike repair shop. Other Oakland Public Library services include a tool lending library and a way to check out an internet hotspot to use at home. In this special broadcast from the Oakland Public Library, 81st Avenue branch in East Oakland, we're looking at the role of libraries in the digital age. And joining us is Jamie Turbeck. She's director of the Oakland Public Library. Welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Anthony Propernick here, Outreach and Community Engagement Coordinator with the Oakland Public Library. Welcome.
Thank you, and welcome to you as well.
And we'll also welcome RB. RB is library aide here at the 81st Avenue branch, Oakland Public Library. Also heads the Scraper Bike Team and offers bike fix-it clinics at the library. Good to have you.
Hey, good morning.
And we'll also say good morning to Wayne Wiegand. He's American Library historian, author of Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library, and a book called The Desegregation of Public Libraries in the Jim Crow South, Civil Rights and Local Activism. Wayne Wiegand, good to have you back on Forum.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you, and glad to have this live studio audience, live library audience. And let me begin, if I may, Jamie Turbeck, with you. Let's talk about how libraries have changed. Now, we've done that before on Forum, but to change to the degree that this particular branch has changed is really, in many ways, if I may say so, extraordinary. I mean, it's still a place of learning, it's still a place of education, of books, and all of that, but who would have thought, for example, you'd have a critical response team, which you do?
Yes, this particular branch is our newest branch of the Oakland Public Library. It was built about 8 years ago. So it was really our first attempt at being as responsive to the community as we can. It's very flexible and has a lot of different programming. What we're trying to do at the Oakland Public Library is be very responsive to the needs of the community and be as flexible as we can as a government institution to whatever those needs may be. So for the critical response team, that's a group of staff that were formed to sort of respond to any sort of immediate need, either a national issue that's going on, a local issue, provide information to citizens, or offer support in any way. So, for instance, there were recently ICE raids in Oakland, and we did a lot of work on immigration and immigration rights, and we had different legal experts come in and talk to the community as well as provide information to patrons who are coming into the library.
Well, next to the police, you're the most public institution in Oakland, we should add, and have actually been a place of refuge for people during after the ghost ship fire and that whole tragedy, and also refuge for those who were seeking sanctuary during the ICE raids. Now, Mayor Schaaf got a lot of pushback for that. What about the library?
I believe we were one of the places that people consider safe. Although we are a government institution, I don't think the general public recognizes us as such, and so we feel like a neutral place for people to come.
But it was, in other words, when I asked for pushback, the community said, this is okay, it's a sanctuary city, we're all for it, as opposed to the kind of response nationally that we saw where Oakland was used as a kind of whipping city from Trump on down.
I believe internally in Oakland, people were very supportive of her position and the stance of trying to be a sanctuary city.
And you're thriving now, largely. Real estate taxes and bond issues seem to go pretty well, too?
Yes, we're very lucky. We had a parcel tax pass in 2018, so almost exactly a year ago. Measure D passed in Oakland, and that generated an additional $10 million for the library. That's allowing us to open about 200 more hours a week across the city, 7 days a week at this particular branch, which has never happened before.
That was Measure D, right?
Correct.
And no more fines.
And no more overdue fines.
Yeah,
so we are officially fine-free.
Why no fines?
We found that they were an economic barrier. It wasn't necessary. They aren't shown. This is a trend that's happening nationally, but they're not shown to increase the return rate of materials. And what they do is disproportionately harm people who can't afford to pay fines. And so rather than pay fines, people will just stay away from the library. So we had a large number of people with what we call blocked cards. So once their library card hit a certain dollar amount threshold, they couldn't check out any more materials, and so they would stop coming, or at least stop checking out materials.
You have a lot of community meeting rooms here, I noticed. What are they used for?
Well, Anthony could probably talk more about that, but we have all kinds of groups that happen. Do you want to speak to that, Anthony?
Sure, I'll jump in.
She gave you your cue, Anthony. Go ahead.
Well, on a rainy day, we host our bike fix-it clinics up here so we can keep them going, keep people riding in the rain. We've had Communities for a Better Environment and different nonprofit community groups come up here and use it. We are hosting the forum today, obviously.
Really? Are we here?
Yes, we are here. We also have done a lot of work with KALW and other programs up there to host certain events up here. We had a film screening event that was brought to us by one of our patrons, Cheryl Fabio. It was on the Black Arts Movement and the history of arts in Oakland, and we included some films with Boots Riley. Sorry to bother you, he was here in this room one night. And that was a series that we did in March. We're open to almost any use of this room. There are not a lot of spaces in the neighborhood or in this area for communities members to have events, and so we just kind of consider everything.
You're trying to establish a good deal of activity and a way for people to find outlets, really, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of getting out of the way and facilitating this amazing space we have. I think the outlets, it's primarily what people want to do and what our patrons and our supporters, I mean, these are people who paid and passed Measure D. They passed it because we're popular in their eyes, because when they come into the library, they feel like they have access to something, and they're gaining access and an opportunity to carry out what they'd like to see or what they want to do. So I think we're just trying to, we don't know what the next event's going to be. We're not coming at it with an idea of, oh, this is what I want to do here at the library. The idea is that we listen and engage with the community, and they inform us with their questions, with their ideas about how we operate this place.
But I was also trying to get at the sense of a philosophy. You want a safe place. I mean, there are problems in this area that is an underserved area to begin with, but problems out on the streets and so forth. You want to draw people into the library and also make it a safe place.
Yeah, I mean, safe, positive, and healthy space. And we do want to offer that to people. We want to offer an alternative, especially to young people who might find, they don't feel insecure in the streets. Kids are coming here on their own. But I think we know that it is an underserved underserved community. And I think providing a space that feels comfortable, that feels welcoming. We resolved a lot of conflicts early on, but now that we've developed relationships and established a community of and expectations of what this shared space is like, it feels safer. It feels like people respect and understand what their needs are in a shared space. And I guess, sure, but the idea of what happens in this building is about thriving and seeking knowledge and community and relationships.
Well, I don't want to act like you're an advanced man here, but, I mean, there's so much going on. There's a father's program. There's a program of yoga instruction, particularly for people from a Mexican-American background, because I know there's a very different library system in Mexico, and that speaks to your background to some extent. But you're really trying to provide games for kids, for example, when they come in. They're parked here sometimes while their parents have to work and come pick them up. There's just a whole range of stuff going on.
Sure. And I think for me personally, I'm not a librarian. That's my disclaimer. And I feel okay about that. I respect and love the profession and the institution. I didn't grow up in libraries as a kid. I was on the streets and I was doing my own thing. And when I came to work for libraries from a community development and a youth development background, I found that and I also worked with farm worker communities in Santa Cruz County, is that a lot of, in this community we have, it's basically a Black and Latino immigrant community, a lot of Mexican immigrants. which was really familiar to me. And I and they walk in the door sometimes to pick up their kids, and they ask, "Oh, is it okay if I come in?" And to be able to communicate to tell them is that that's an informative question. That's saying, "Oh, you don't know what an American public library is," and being open and engaging and pulling them in and sharing with them the kinds of services that we have that they can access here has been a really important motivator for me.
And Anthony Popernick again is outreach and community engagement coordinator here at the Oakland Public Library. RB, Reginald Burnett, known as RB, is library aide at the 81st Avenue branch here, and also heads the Scraper bike team and offers bike fix at clinics. Let's talk about what you do here. People come in. Actually, you make bikes, don't you, as well as fix them?
So we make, refurbish, scraperized bicycles.
Can you say something about scrapers? A lot of people don't know what they are.
So a scraper bike is a custom bike of Oakley. So originally we took duct tape and candy wrappers, and we tricked out our bikes to look similar to like the cars you see riding around on the big rims with the bright flamboyant colors. And we took that concept, and we was a youth and now we're adults, so we use the each one teach one method, and we teach kids youth entrepreneurship. Well, we support youth entrepreneurship through making and decorating bikes.
And you really started something that has grown here. I mean, from the early stages when you were trying to get people more interested in bikes, particularly because there, well, first of all, I know there's no real bike shop near here. That's part of the problem, isn't it?
So we don't have a bike shop in East Oakland. We don't have bikes here in East Oakland. So we created our own. So we got bike donations. All our bikes are donated from local PDs. Stanford donated a lot of bike trips for kids.
And you're riding around Oakland. I mean, that's.
We riding around with bright flamboyant bikes in Oakland. So we bringing hope to Oakland. So our lack of bike infrastructure.
Let me just mention that RB is on not only on the Bike Commission, but is on the City Commission. I think the first from the Flatlands here to be on the City Commission. And this movement is growing. There's really a presence now of bike riders out there in this area and even all the way to West Oakland and so forth. There's also a problem. The problem is riding while black.
Biking while black. I call it biking while broke. due to our disinvestment, what is bike safety? In the lower income community, bike safety is a ticket because I can't afford bike lights. A ticket because I can't ride on the street with 40 mile an hour traffic and it's illegal to ride on a sidewalk. So Bike East Bay introduced me to bike safety as well as bike advocacy. And I found out my lack of bike access in East Oakland, as well as how to teach people to adapt to our crazy style of drivers in East Oakland in what we call SISO City.
Are you making progress, though, particularly with perhaps gang members being more interested in doing something healthy, like being out there on a bike?
We going green in the hood, so we getting active in a positive way. So we're promoting unity, and we're not promoting gang violence or drugs. So we the library provided us a safe space where we could create a people place for the community. So we invite the kids to come here. They can be safe. We could spark their creativity from making a bike, and we can inspire them to do better by referring them to check out a book. So that's my approach as far as, in the community. We want to promote a good community. We don't want to promote the negatives that everyone portrays on each other.
What I really want to ask you is, you feel you're having impact?
Definitely. We're having a global impact. As you know, me and Anthony won an award in 2017, Movers and Shakers. I spoke on webinars. I did a lot of panels. And they all want to know, How do we make the program successful and succeed? And it was just creating people's space and listening to the community.
Well, congratulations to you and Anthony. And Wayne Wiegand is also with us, American Library historian, author of Part of Our Lives and the Desegregation of Public Libraries in the Jim Crow South. And this is kind of right in line with what you've been saying for years, Wayne Wiegand, that is, libraries ought to respond to the people who use the libraries.
Yeah, well, one of the things about public libraries is that they have to have a public. And so that public, over the years, has crafted a series of forces on the services of the public library that are quite evident. The fact that you see books circulating, particular kinds of books, are a response to public pressure. In the early years, public libraries wanted to give you the literary canon, so to speak, the really best books that the literary critics thought were outstanding. But the public said, no, 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 I want romances, and I want science fiction, and I want westerns. And that demand, in effect, shifted how public libraries responded to their publics, the fact that the public has that force. I always say that to my students, there is no holy book in which God tells us what a library should be. People make libraries, and they can make them pretty much anything they want.
Well, my mother did say that God had a book. He just ended any lie that you told in that book. And that was what I heard from almost diapers on. You look at the purpose of a library now, though, and it has a lot to do not only with social activism here in Oakland being a prime example, but it also has a great deal to do with generating a way beyond the kind of gap that exists, especially with the Internet.
I'm a historian, and I tend to think in terms of centuries rather than lifetimes. So as I'm listening to the panel members up here, I'm thinking, oh, there's a historical precedent in Sauk Center, Minnesota in 1895. Oh, that's a historical precedent in Cleveland Public Library in 1922. So a lot of what you all are talking about here is really a tradition of public library service rather than something new in the 21st century.
Does that go to, for example, taking in homeless, which is a lot of what they do in the San Francisco Public Library and other libraries?
Your phrase, taking in homeless, is something I wouldn't characterize it as taking in homeless. When the Boston Public
Accessible to homeless,
yes,
availability to homeless.
You know, okay. When the Boston Public Library opened in 1854, homeless were among the first people to frequent it.
And that has continued to be a kind of social mission in many libraries throughout the country. And here's some good news, and I found this out from reading you. There are more libraries in the United States now, more public libraries, than there are McDonald's franchises. Talk about things to be hopeful about.
If you look at the statistics, I'm old now, so I remember the 1980s quite well, when a number of evangelists of information technology were not only predicting the demise of the book, they were predicting the demise of the public library. From 1980 on, if you plot the trend in growth of libraries, there's only been 1 year when the number of libraries has decreased a bit, and that's because some cities closed up some branches and opened up a few more elsewhere. So the number of libraries today is as high as it has ever been.
And let me ask you about desegregation of libraries, because that's a field of expertise for you. I mean, during the Jim Crow years, especially in the South, African Americans couldn't even get into libraries, although there's a great story Richard Wright tells about in Natchez, Mississippi, going and giving a note to a librarian, which he wrote, and it said, give this N boy a copy of Mencken. He wanted to read H.L. Mencken, the somewhat, shall we say, at that time, subversive columnist for the Baltimore Sun, and he assumed that if he wrote that note, they wouldn't think it was for him, but it was for him, of course.
It was. It was two books by H.L. Mencken, and he fooled the librarian into giving him those books by saying that I'm getting this for white people. It happened in the 1920s.
But that idea of integrating libraries was really something that had major force behind it through the Civil Rights Movement and in conjunction with the Civil Rights Movement.
That's correct. But I want to also mention that while swimming pools and recreation sites and parks, cities would close them rather than integrate them, public libraries became sites of racial reconciliation. There was no public library that remained closed for more than a few months after African-American kids came in and said, well, you're going to integrate this library.
And you were talking about not only the fear of extinction of libraries, but they thought radio would do that, they thought TV would do that, and then, of course, they thought the Internet would do that.
That's right. I think of three particular decades in the 20th century. 1920s, when there was panic in library profession about what the radio would do. Everybody's going to stay home and listen to stories on the radio. Didn't happen. 1950s, when everybody was going to stay home and watch TV, and this was going to be the demise of the public library. Didn't happen. And again, those 1980s evangelists of information technology predicting the demise of public libraries. That didn't happen either.
Well, let me actually invite our listeners and also our live audience here to participate in this discussion about libraries. I make no bones about it. I love and support libraries. The young lady in the front here has an I Love Libraries t-shirt on, wearing that. Many of you here are enthusiasts about the libraries that you service or the libraries that you support or the libraries that you go to. I want to hear from our listeners. Just how do libraries serve you, and what about the changes that have gone on with libraries, some of them quantum changes in terms of particularly social activism and being places, as we said, of sanctuary, not only for the homeless, but also for people who are in sanctuary cities. We welcome your involvement in the program, and we are going to give you a toll-free number where you can join us at now. And those of you in the audience simply have to raise your hand, and we will come to you and answer any questions we hope that you have or hear comments that you might have. You can join us now, and let us find out how you use your local libraries and how does your library serve the particular needs of your community. You can give us a call at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. I'll repeat the number again. It's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and on Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments to us, forum@kqed.org. And let me go back to you, if I may, just for a moment here, Jamie Turbeck. Jamie Turbeck, again, is the director of the Oakland Public Library. What do you do in terms of what Anthony and the others have been talking about? I mean, in terms of making sure that you're serving the community, other than have kind of a suggestion box, I mean, how do you bring people in to get them involved and get them telling you what they not want, what they need?
Our staff at the Oakland Public Library are very invested in the community. We hire from the community, and they spend all day long talking with the people who come in the library. So when they come to me with a suggestion or an idea, I know it's really rooted in whatever they've been experiencing on the what we call the front line. So we have an amazing staff at the Oakland Public Library, and I...
All hired locally for the most part? Yeah.
For the most part, we try... Yes, exactly. And we're trying very hard to promote within, so we're trying to hire locally and then encourage people to, you know, further their library careers and either get permanent jobs at the library or go to library school.
As long as they can afford to live in Oakland, right?
Yes, that's an issue.
I'm sure that's an issue. We'll talk about other issues, and we'll talk more about libraries. If you've just joined us, we're talking about how libraries stay relevant in the digital age. And again, we want to hear from you, and how is your library relevant, or how can you make it more relevant? How does it serve your needs? And again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786, and I invite those in the audience to join us as well and talk about how the library serves you and what you get most out of your libraries. That's our focus, and stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about libraries this hour. We are live from the library here in East Oakland, 81st Avenue Library, and we have an audience here as well who are eager to let you know they're here. Thank you for that. Also with us this hour here in the Oakland Library is Jamie Turbeck. She's director of the Oakland Public Library. Anthony Propernick is Outreach and Community Engagement Coordinator with the Oakland Public Library, and R.B. is Library 8 at the 81st Avenue Branch Library. He also heads the Scraper Bike Team and offers bike fix-it clinics at the library. And Wayne Wiegand, American Library historian and author of Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. I've got to ask you, RB, how do you make helmets cool?
That's a good question. I was just saying, how do you make helmets cool? That's a question I had as well. So my idea of making helmets cool is bike safety. When I do bike safety, the league requires a kid to wear a helmet. California law requires anyone under 18 to wear a helmet. So we try to get them the decorated duct tape and candy wrappers.
There you go. Great resource. And Anthony, if I could go to you again, I'm just wondering what it is that we maybe haven't covered here. And there's a lot of things that fall into the role of the library now, including even child care, yeah?
Well, I'm not sure I would say child care, although it's a perceived idea that children can, it's a safe place for children, for parents to drop their children off.
That's kind of an ex post facto child care.
We are raising kids yeah. here. It's a community effort. And I want to say back, I mean, I know that the Scraper Bike team, for example, is a very exciting and a beautiful thing to see. But at the core of that is a relationship that RB and other members of the team have with younger kids, younger people, and how they mentor them. And the bikes are just facilitating that. I think so there are challenges in that too, like the helmets, and it's something we talk about a lot. we give them away free, and we decorate them, and we're still trying to get the kids to wear them. But I would like to go back on RB. How the bike program started was a response to a community need and information that we had for Bike to Work Month back in 2014, a bike workshop clinic here at the library where East Bay came in and did show people how to fix bikes. And we fixed bikes that afternoon for 4 hours, the security guard, myself, fixing flats. And what we realized, or people realized actually, is that we knew how to fix flats. And then suddenly all these rusted bikes started coming out of backyards and showing up at the library at all our open hours. And I knew RB from an Earth Day event over at Tassafaronga, local community center and park around the corner. And I knew I knew the work that he did. And he's a community hero in my mind, the work and the efforts. And I invited him to come back and talk about launching these clinics here in response to this information that I was getting from the community. And that's how that all started. So he's a perfect example of that partnership. Now he's kind of an institution within the library, and we house two bike fix-it clinics both here at 81st and at the Martin Luther King branch.
RB has done great work, but as he reminds us, you still need a bike shop here, don't you? In the community?
I mean, the dream is to one day have a bike shop in East Oakland, but as Anthony was saying, like, we partnered with the Catholic Workers before I ended up getting a job with the library. And so Catholic Workers lost their funding for their building, El Colectivo, on 50th. And then Anthony was like, well, they did the bike safety class, and it was a lecture, and a lot of people showed up to get their bike fixed. And he was like, well, you ever thought about working at the library? And so in that time, I was part of a Build Action Environment team. And we all met here at 81st Library, so it was the Scraper Bikes and a bunch of other community organizations, and we met here. Anthony offered me a job. They wrote a grant, a Bikes to Books grant, and he's like, "Well, welcome to the library." And ever since then, we've been promoting people over things.
And who would have thought even you'd wind up on the city council, no less. But also, you've pointed out that besides a bike shop here in East Oakland, you really could use a grocery store, and you could use perhaps even most better access to transportation. Let me go back to Wayne Wiegand and ask you, how healthy financially are libraries now? I mean, there was a period, particularly during the recession, where they were talking about librarians going out with a cup in their hand, that sort of thing.
The fiscal health of the public libraries across the nation rises and falls with the economy. It's that simple. 85% to 90% of revenues that public libraries rely on come from real estate taxes. So when the economy tanks, and that's the irony is, those are the moments when people increase their demands on public libraries during bad times. The Great Depression, for example, a lot of libraries lost 20, 30, 40% of their budgets, and the unemployed were coming through their doors and saying, we need these services. So that's the irony of the whole thing. When local economies tank, services are in greater demand in public libraries.
Could you say a word about financial health here, Jamie, at the Oakland Public Library?
Yes, I'll say that we were an example of that in 2009 when the recession hit. We had to close libraries There was a proposal on the table to close as many as 8 libraries throughout Oakland. The voters and the activists rallied on our behalf, and we were able to sort of compromise with a reduction in hours of service. So we went from being open 6 days a week to being open 5 days a week. So this recent passage of Measure D has restored those cut hours for the first time in almost a decade. And so, again, it's true that we're very reliant on the general fund and on property taxes.
Jamie Torbeck again is director of the Oakland Public Library. Let's go to our audience here, and we have Karen in the audience. Karen, join us. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for being here. I was practically driving down 880 and found that this event was in Oakland, so this is a great treat. I wanted to mention that I'm from Detroit. Claire Jones was my local librarian. I felt my personal librarian, became the head of the Detroit Public Libraries, and eventually moved out here when she retired to be with her daughter. But my first chapter book when she was my librarian was Bambi. And as I look back, that was an awful book, you know. But
the mother was killed, right?
Yes. I checked it out many times. I don't know how much my mom paid in fines, but I wanted to ask, you know, what are you doing to recruit librarians? Is that a challenge, particularly librarians of color who can influence the kids who come into the library?
Thank you for the question. Let me go back to you, Jamie Turbin.
Yes, that's it's an issue that nationally the profession is aware of, that librarianship has been dominated for many, many years, maybe for longer, by white women. And I think for most library systems in the Bay Area, it's a requirement to get a master's of library science in order to be hired as a librarian. So I find that it's not a common profession for diverse populations to move into. I think it's just not particularly intuitive. So we've been doing a lot to sort of market librarianship, and what we found to be most successful lately is what I talked about earlier, which is just hiring people locally, really investing in them through a lot of training and opportunities while they work for years for the Oakland Public Library, and then supporting their we have scholarships for them to go to library school if they choose to do that, or again, just giving them a lot of opportunities in whatever classification they're in. We've been able to send quite a few people, have graduated from library school and have then been hired as librarians for the Oakland Public Library.
And you yourself came up kind of through the ranks, didn't you?
Yes, I started as a library aide about 19 years ago, so I've worked up through the system, and that's what I sort of encourage all the staff that we hire to at least consider. I think a lot of people start working at the library probably unintentionally, a little bit like Anthony and RB, and then they can really find that there's a way for them to give back to their community and whatever their passions kind of inspire them to do.
And find a home away from home, really, too. Yeah.
Yes. But anyway, to your point, I think we really need diversity in our profession and in libraries throughout the Bay Area. So if you're thinking of library school or library work, please reach out to us or any of your local libraries.
Get the message out there, and we'll take one of our callers. Emily is joining us from Oakland. Hi, Emily. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. Fine. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I moved here from Atlanta, Georgia, about 3 years ago, and I homeschooled my daughter. And the second day we got here, the first thing we did was find the libraries. Nothing else, just the libraries. And we were so impressed with how many libraries there were in the city of Oakland. We are homeschoolers. We continue to be homeschoolers. And she goes to a support program that also uses the library system called Abundant Beginnings. And the doors are always open to the kids when it's a rainy day because it's an outdoor school. So we're just so thankful of it, and we're thankful of the system. We love to use the downtown library and the little cute Lake Merritt library as well as the Diamond. And they know us. Over 3 years, we'll walk in. My daughter is the slime girl who comes up and looks for the slime recipe books and all the Garfield books. And it's just a wonderful place for families, and we enjoy looking around and seeing how many diverse people are actually using the library and the library system. And we, as homeschooling parents who take out between three cards, we take out about 120 books. We very much appreciate the fact that you have dropped the fees. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Emily, for that call. And let me read a couple comments that are coming in here before we go back to our audience. Vincent says, please mention all the different people who help the Oakland libraries. There are many volunteers who provide IT support, legal advice, and people who grind on OPD to keep the surrounding areas free of drug use and sales. And Jay writes, I grew up in India, and we did not have library facilities anywhere close to the system we have here in the USA. I'm a patron of the San Jose Public Library System. In many ways, the library is similar to public radio. While browsing, I often stumble upon something interesting that I wasn't looking for in the first place. Let me go to the audience, and Mike has a question. Mike, join us.
Good morning, and thank you for having this program. I think there are a lot of things that have not been mentioned about the great things that the library does. So I just want to mention a few more things. I have a lot of different interests. I love reading. But, you know, you can't afford to buy every single book. You can't afford to subscribe to every magazine. So I think for a lot of folks without the services of the public library, we would be a much poorer society. I think another couple of things that the library really does that I really find very important. Throughout the year, I'm at the library, and occasionally on the loudspeaker, things will come up to be announcements. If you're under 18, there are free meals for you available during the summer. Come in for tax assistance. There are services for veterans. Come to a certain room, and there will be assistance to help you with doing your resume if you're unemployed. These are really important services that the library provides, and I want to thank you for that.
Thank you for that. I like the analogy the caller made of public radio, too, because public libraries and public public broadcasting of all kinds really are designed to serve the public in every way we can, and I think certainly people appreciate what we do and just the range and diversity of what we do. I want to get to another caller, though, and that's Heather. Join us, Heather. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, this is Heather, and I'm a community librarian here in the East Bay. And I first want to give a shout-out to the Temescal library staff. That's my branch library, and I love those guys, and they keep it real, and I love them. But my question is actually for the panelists, and this has to do with privacy. So I've found in my role as a library leader that the recently we've been asked a lot in terms of justifying our funding and our hours and our services to provide more and more granular information about who is using the library, how they're using it, you know, what types of services and resources are being used. And I'm wondering how OPL, and if there's other librarians out there, how you're balancing these demands to provide patron information or information about demographics and, you know, the not necessarily the complete identity of your patrons, but information that gives kind of a picture of who's using your library and how they're using it, and how you balance that against one of the, like, core tenets of being a librarian, which is the ethic that says that we protect our patrons' privacy. We allow them to come in and use the resources, check out materials for whatever purpose that they need. So I'm wondering how you're balancing privacy needs against demands for, you know, providing a picture of who's using libraries.
Can I go to the head librarian about that again?
Yes. So we're very, very conscious of privacy. Again, this is a historical philosophy for libraries to protect patron privacy. At the Oakland Public Library a number of years ago, we actually looked at this and decided to collect less material from library patrons. So the thought was that if we don't have the information to begin with, we can't be subject to it being compromised. So we stopped collecting gender. We no longer verify ID. You don't need to have a physical address, so for people who may be unhoused or not be able to provide proof of address. So, and then there's a lot of people who use our computers at the library. So the computer software wipes clean any record of use after each person uses it. So the way we can track usage then is more anonymously. So we do keep data on how many people come into the library. We know how many books get checked out. We know when visitation is high. But none of that information is tied to particular users. So I think we can justify what we're doing, and we can figure out where certain zip codes have more people who have library cards or less, but we don't actually have to tie it to individuals, and that, I think, ensures that people's individual privacy is protected.
What about the other kind of privacy? People come in the library sometimes, and they certainly want a library to be silent or at least as quiet as possible, a place for repose and meditation and study and whatnot, and sometimes people come in the library and they make noise and they're loud, and also they bother other people. So what can the library do to police that, so to speak?
Yeah, I think one of the things about being a truly public institution is that the public is a big number of people who have different needs. And so there's a lot of navigation that happens. The staff, again, do a lot of work to help finesse that. Anthony's somebody, again, who's really good at that. But partly it's carving out different areas or times. So one thing that can be done is if somebody likes a quiet library, we might encourage them to come when school's in session, because once school gets out, the library volume goes up a little bit. There are certain locations that have more quiet areas than others. So the main library on the second floor and the magazine and newspaper room or the history room tends to be more quiet. If you're going to hang out in the teen zone at the main library, it's not going to be quiet. So I think by offering a variety of spaces and times, and again, now that we're open more hours, I've found right now that Sunday mornings are quite quiet. So if you're not using your library on Sunday mornings, please come on down, because we're looking for more foot traffic.
We should mention, as we did initially, that the library serves a couple of elementary schools here. And Megan tweets, I use my local library to take my fifth graders to check out books since my school doesn't have a library. And Alex tweets, libraries are more than books. EdTech blogger Phil Shapiro mentioned once that he installs Linux on laptops for library patrons free of charge. And a lot of props here for the library. Liam says, shout out to the Oakland Library's History Room. I would never be able to produce my local history podcast without it. Every time I visit, I bump into authors, activists, and other community members utilizing the archives collected by this amazing resource. Look at any book written about Oakland in the last decade, and you'll see the name of Dorothy Lazard, who runs the History Room, in the thank you section. Quick question for you, Wayne. A number of years ago, there was very little bookshelf available. Nicholson Baker was outraged at the fact that the San Francisco Public Library was burning books. We hadn't heard that since, I think, World War II and the fascists. But the fact of the matter is there just wasn't enough room, and that still remains a problem?
Yes and no. The issue with the San Francisco Public Library was they were moving from an old building to a newer building. And in the newer building, the people who were helping to design it had a particular view of what the future would be. And that future at the time was being influenced by people who were saying it's all going to be on the internet, et cetera. So they didn't make enough space for the books that existed in the old library. Unfortunately, then they tried to get rid of all those books. So I would say when public libraries plan for the future, they need to understand several things. For all of their history, public libraries have served three major purposes. We've given most of our attention to just one of those purposes, and that's providing practical information. That comes out of the French Enlightenment, actually. The phrase used to be useful knowledge. But the second thing, historically, that I can prove it to you, is it's a community space. And we know that now in the 21st century. We didn't recognize it very much prior to the 21st century. And the third thing is the transformative potential of fiction. An example for we tend to think that there will be less demand for books than there has in the past. Now, where we get that idea, I'm not exactly certain, but the demand for books now has to accommodate e-books. Circulation in public libraries may have decreased slightly in the past several years because now they're circulating e-books, or excuse me, visitors in the public libraries have been reduced nationwide in the past several years. And part of the reason, I suspect, is because people are checking out e-books through the library system. So those three things, transformative potential of fiction, community center, and practical information that libraries have always provided. Anybody planning a library in the future, look at your community, keep those things in mind. And you may need more bookshelves than you thought you did.
Good to hear a historian speculate on the need for the future. And let's go to more audience questions. And next question from the audience comes from Amy. Amy, join us. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much. Wayne, I actually have the question to you. There's one, at least one East Oakland high school, middle school, and the statistics are 85.5% of those students do not use the public library. So I'm curious, and then I find that in most of the school libraries, there's often non-use of public libraries. Could you discuss some of the history of school libraries and public libraries?
Yeah, the first half of the 20th century, there were many arrangements just like in this building here. That is, you've had a school and a library sort of combined. Often public libraries provided classroom collections. Often they provided staffing and collections for the central library in a particular school. These things have shifted over history to when Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty programs emerged in the 1960s, a lot of federal funding went to school libraries, and you saw an explosion of school libraries at that time. Many of those libraries still exist today, but they tend to be underfunded because in our test and measurement climate, and where teachers are being forced to teach to the test, the library doesn't prosper it very well in that particular environment. The kids aren't being encouraged to be curious and follow inquiry, if you will, which is where the library does best. It does best in incidental knowledge rather than intentional knowledge, incidental education rather than intentional education, which is what the school is set up to do. So I'm not surprised at the statistics there. If the principal, if the superintendent are not heavy allies of school libraries will be underutilized. School librarians, I'll say this about California, I live here now, California is the worst state in the union for providing certified school librarians, by far.
And again, Wayne Wiegand is an American library historian. Before we go to more calls or more audience questions, let me go back, if I may, Anthony Propernick, to you. You wanted to add something about child care here at the Oakland Public Library?
Well, and it's kind of relevant to the question the audience member just asked, is that in our situation, we probably have 80 to 90% of the students next door using our location. And what that has done for us is create this environment of children after school, especially, that then comes over and into the weekend. We're open now 7 days a week here at 81st, thanks to Measure D. But after school, we have to embrace this idea that, you know, parents in a community, a low-income community, and as a father, I know how much childcare costs, there's not opportunities for those parents to get those children care after school. So they're trusting in the public library, and it's a tricky thing for us to manage because we can't be care providers, but we have to be open and welcoming to these kids. So we do the snack programs, and in relationship to different use and quiet space, you know, facilitating this space between, it's such an opportunity to have an adult working on a resume and four youth playing a video game on computers next to each other to try to figure out how do we do this together? What can we offer to both and validate like the concerns for both parties here and figure out a way to get them what they need out of this space.
And we'll go back to our audience and we'll welcome Aaron from the audience.
Hi, Aaron Michael. It sounds as though you've created a range of really powerful services in response to the community's needs. I'd love to get a sense of how you think that's going to evolve over the course of, say, the next 10 years or so, both in response to needs and in response to technology as well, here in Oakland, and if you have insight nationally.
Jamie, go ahead.
Well, I think we're working on knowing what that looks like. I think building up a staff, as I talked about, that's really responsive to the community will help guide our direction. The technology, Oakland Public Library has been a little bit behind other library systems in terms of technology. We were underfunded for many years, and so again, I think we're just catching up this year. But our technology is getting a lot stronger. We've got Wi-Fi at all of our locations. We're on what's called the scenic backbone, which gives really fast broadband connectivity. We're getting replacement computers, again, per Measure D. We're going to have laptops at most locations. At Diamond Branch, which was a new location, well, not a new location, but it was recently remodeled. We put in a checkout. It's basically a kiosk, like a vending machine for laptops, so people can come and check out a laptop, and that provides additional computer access and on top of the desktop computers.
Jamie, hear the music. That means we have seconds left. Can you recommend for interested future librarians, since you mentioned it, where it's best for them to obtain a degree? Some listener named Marjorie wants to know, San Jose State or UC Berkeley have a program?
San Jose State is one of the last library schools in California, but there's many online programs, so it's pretty easy to get a library degree online these days if you can't travel to San Jose.
Well, thank you, Jamie Turbeck, Director of the Oakland Public Library. Thank you, Anthony Popernick, Outreach and Community Engagement Coordinator for the Oakland Public Library. And thank you, RB, Library Aide at the 81st Avenue Branch, who also heads the Scraper Bike Team and offers Bike Fix It clinics at the library. And Wayne Wiegand, we thank you, American Library Historian and author of Part of Our Lives. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.